Welcome back, True Crime Dimes. You might have deduced from its title and the fact that it's a true crime podcast that this show will cover potentially upsetting content. In addition to detailed accounts of all manner of horrific acts, this podcast will also entail the vital and varied use of curse words, BIPOC allyship, love for the LGBTQ plus community, using people's correct pronouns, and other pretty liberal shit. If any of that's gonna upset you, exit now. This is Trigger Warning, a true crime podcast. I'm your host, Jen O'Malley, and you've been warned. This is the second episode of an unofficial two-part series. I strongly suggest listening to last week's episode, The Masked Rapist, before continuing with this one. Despite what you may have heard, Richmond, Virginia in the 80s and 90s was not regarded as an extremely safe place to live, nor was it a typical sleepy southern town. Only the wealthy white people in their clustered little neighborhoods on the fringe of the city felt that way. In fact, Richmond was literally one of the murder capitals of the United States. In 1987, there were 82 murders. The next year, 100, the first year of triple-digit killings in the River City since the Civil War. Richmond finally took first place in this shittiest of competitions in 1997 with 67.2 killings per 100,000 citizens, which was 140 murders, and that was down from their 1994 high of 161. Way to go, RVA. Before we move on, I need to tell you that as a Richmonder, I really do love this city. Although it still has its issues, it's come a long way. Richmond is now a cultural mecca for artists and musicians, foodies, the gays, history buffs, outdoor recreationists, you name it. But back then, not so much. Between 1 and 2 a.m. on Saturday, September 19th, 1987, a resident of Southside noticed a strange vehicle parked outside of his home. When he got up at 6:30 that morning, it was still there, with the keys in the ignition and the engine running, so he called the Richmond Bureau of Police to report it. Police checked the Department of Motor Vehicles records and found that the abandoned vehicle was registered to Debbie Dudley Davis at 4520 Devonshire Road, only 4 blocks from where the car was found. When they went to notify Debbie at her Westover Hills apartment, police discovered her dead body, clad only in shorts, lying face down on her bed. She'd been raped, sodomized, and strangled with a ligature and ratchet-type device made from a thick woolen sock and 16-inch metal vacuum cleaner tube attachment. According to court documents, the pressure used to kill Debbie was so great that it cut into her neck muscles, larynx, and voice box. Her hands were bound by shoestrings, with her left wrist in front of her and her right wrist behind her, attached to the ligature device. Her mouth, nose, and vagina were bruised. The killer had left a large amount of semen from masturbating during the crime. 3 deposits on the comforter, 4 on the fitted sheet. And to that I say, ugh! The killer gained entrance to Debbie's apartment by raising the screen in a kitchen window that was about 8 feet off the ground. He'd stolen a rocking chair from a nearby porch to boost himself up. Marcel Slag arrived home around 1:30 a.m. on Saturday, October 3rd. He heard his wife, Dr. Susan Hellams, moving around upstairs and thought he'd awakened her, so he quietly took a quick shower to keep from disturbing her further. But when he entered their bedroom, he saw Susan on the floor, half in the closet. He called police at 1:56 a.m. Susan was still warm. It seems that it wasn't her that Marcel had heard moving around upstairs, but the killer. Susan had been beaten, raped, sodomized, and strangled. She was nude above the waist. Her skirt and slip had been pulled up, underwear removed. She had red socks on both feet and 1 red shoe on her left foot. There were 2 belts around her neck, a red one with a black one attached to it like a leash. Her wrists were tied tightly behind her back with an extension cord and a blue belt. Yet another belt was found around the lower portion of her left leg, thought to have been tied around both her ankles at some point. Susan had a fractured nose, blunt force injury to her lower lip, and various bruises and scrapes. There was an injury and a smudge of roofing tar from the balcony on the back of her right leg, made by the killer's shoe when he placed his foot there for leverage as he strangled her. There was semen on her breasts, back, genital area, and in her gluteal fold, the area where your butt and thigh meet, and on her skirt and slip. The killer had gained access to the home at 514 West 31st Street by scaling the 6-foot security fence that enclosed the backyard, using it to reach the second-story porch immediately outside of Susan's bedroom window, and cutting out a large portion of the window screen. Police assumed that the killer was young, strong, and agile due to the way he entered. He stole Susan's violin and her diamond ring. He left behind an open jar of Vaseline that he'd used as lube, as well as a 3-foot length of rope. Clearly, he'd been in a hurry to leave once he realized someone had come home. The Chos left their home on Gavilan Court at Chesterfield Village Apartments and headed to work in the early morning hours of Sunday, November 22nd, letting their two kids sleep in, 15-year-old Diane and 12-year-old Robert. The Chos ran a convenience store near Virginia Commonwealth University in downtown Richmond, about 15 minutes from their apartment in Chesterfield County. They closed early on Sundays to attend a weekly afternoon church service as a family. So after a few hours at work, Mrs. Cho, Yun, called her kids to remind them to get showered, get their clothes ready, you know, the usual mom stuff. Yun called again right before closing the shop to make sure the kids would be ready to go on time. When Robert said that Diane was still sleeping, Mama Cho told him to go get her up so they wouldn't be late. But no one wants to wake a sleeping teenager, and Robert was no exception, so the Chos headed home. When I was a teenager and my aunt was visiting, they'd send my cousin in to wake me up because she was little and cute. They knew I wouldn't fuss at her, whereas I was a walking ball of hormonal rage if an adult woke me up. Good times. The Chos returned around 2 p.m. and Mrs. Cho headed straight to Diane's room. Robert heard her scream. She'd found Diane's nude body face down on her bed, partially covered by a sheet. Her mouth had been duct taped. Her hands had been tied behind her back with rope. Another rope was around her neck, in a slipknot, with the free end running down her back, tied to her hands. She'd been strangled to death so viciously that the rope left a deep dent in her neck. Her brother called the police. In an interview with Richard Foster for Southern Nightmare, Robert, who has since changed his name, said, "I remember the operator asking me if I could administer CPR and me telling her that there wasn't any point, that she was dead." Diane had vaginal and anal injuries, as well as injuries to the top of her head. There was blood on her butt, genitals, and sheets. Seminal fluid was found in her vagina, as well as in unusually large amounts in 3 different places on the sheets. An infinity symbol, or the number 8, had been painted on her left hip with pink fingernail polish. The bottle of polish was missing. Police found no signs of struggle in Diane's room, and nothing disturbed in the apartment, except the window screen in her room. The window was unlocked, the screen frame had been broken and tossed on the ground outside. The killer had raped, sodomized, and murdered Diane as her parents and brother slept in their rooms just feet away. On Tuesday, December 1st, Audrey Sizelove tried to enter her friend Sue Tucker's Arlington townhouse because her bedroom window had been open for days, Sue's husband was back in his home country of Wales waiting for her to join him, and Audrey couldn't get in touch with her. The chain was on the door, but Audrey detected the unmistakable odor of rotting flesh and called the police. Even though Arlington is over 100 miles away from Richmond, I'm sure you're not surprised at this point that police found Sue's decomposing, naked body face down on her bed with a blue sleeping bag draped over her butt, a brown blanket under her, and her nightgown beside her. There were large semen stains on all 3 items because Sue had been raped and strangled. There was a slip-knotted nylon rope around her neck with its free end tying her hands together behind her back. Her purse and its contents had been dumped on the floor. She'd been dead for 3 to 5 days. Although her bedroom window was open, the killer had broken a basement window at the rear of the townhouse to gain entry. Before leaving, he'd had a little snack and discarded the partially eaten orange on Sue's dining room table. Gotta keep your energy up for committing horrendous fucking murders, I guess. While you weren't surprised by what had been done to Sue, Arlington County police were. At that time, they had only a handful of murders each year in their locality, which meant that homicides in general stood out, but even more so ones that were especially heinous. Yeah, I just heard the Law & Order SVU intro in my head too, but the sound is trademarked, so dun dun. Sue's murder reminded detectives of another from just a few blocks away. That victim had also been found naked, face down, hands tied behind her back, rope around her neck, raped, and strangled to death. That victim was Carolyn Holm. That murder had supposedly been solved. It had been committed almost 4 years earlier, and David Vasquez was in prison for it. Although the Holm case was not originally his, Arlington County Police Homicide Detective Joe Horgas reviewed it because he just couldn't shake how similar the 2 murders were. There was a theory that David had an accomplice that was still free because police didn't think he could have committed the rape and murder of Carolyn on his own. On Monday, December 7th, Detective Horgus went to interview David at Buckingham Correctional Center. He believed that after a few years in prison, David would be ready to roll on his partner and finally give up the guy's name. But it didn't play out that way, and when Horgus left the prison, he told the warden, "I don't think Vasquez belongs here. He's innocent." Horgus was more convinced than ever that the same man had committed both crimes and David had no part in either. Horgus found a report in the Hom case file of a crime that had occurred a block away from Carolyn's house around the time of her murder. Someone had broken into a woman's home and laid out cut Venetian blind cords on her bed, but left before she returned. Remember the carrots, y'all? This is that incident. That led Horgus to the other attacks and made him wonder if the masked rapist, Carolyn Hom's killer, and Sue Tucker's murderer were the same person. The very next day, a teletype came across his desk. It read, "For police information only, not for press. This department is investigating two homicides. The first occurred on 9/18/87 around midnight. A white female, 35, was found in her apartment on 9/19/87 at 0940 hours. She had been bound with her hands behind her back. She had also been raped. The apartment was entered through an open rear window with the screen closed. The suspect raised the screen and entered the apartment. There was no sign of any struggle in the assault or the murder. On 10/3/87, 0140 hours, the victim, white female, 32, was found in her bedroom. The house was entered from a second-story window that was opened, but the screen was closed. The screen in this case was cut out and laid on the second-story porch. In both cases, the victims were strangled to death. Any department with similar case, please contact Richmond Bureau of Police or Detective Glenn D. Williams. Thanks for your help in advance." Horgus was immediately on the phone. Homicide Detective Glenn Williams with the Richmond Bureau of Police, who was working the case with Homicide Detective Ray Williams, no relation, updated Detective Horgus with information about Diane Cho's murder and told him that they'd already sent semen samples from the Davis and Helms murders to Life Codes, a private lab in New York that analyzed DNA for paternity tests. Remember that in 1987, DNA testing was still new science. It wasn't even 10 years old yet, and had thus far only been used in one rape case in the US and one murder case in the UK a year earlier, Colin Pitchfork, I'm 100% serious, who raped and murdered two teenage girls. Horgus asked if anything else had been happening in Richmond in the same neighborhood as the other murders. Williams responded, "Well, we do got this black guy running around doing some shit." On Sunday, November 1st, 1987, at 3 a.m., a woman in Westover Hills, the same area where Debbie Davis and Susan Helms had lived, was asleep in her first floor apartment bedroom. She was awakened by a black man wearing work gloves and a ski mask. He held her at knife point and demanded that she take a shower. He then forced her to drink a half bottle of Southern Comfort that he'd brought with him, along with a vibrator and some rope, in a bag tied to his waist. The man used the rope to bind her hands, then assaulted and raped her for 3 hours. He began to bind her ankles, but her upstairs neighbor heard her cries and came to check on her. The rapist fled through the kitchen window, stealing some of the woman's accounting textbooks, which he dropped as he ran. Like, what? I don't even understand that. Textbooks are heavy, and not even accounting students want accounting textbooks. Plus, dropping textbooks as you run, leaving a Hansel and Gretel-style breadcrumb trail for the police, is idiotic. Horgus tried to convince Williams that all the cases were linked, but Williams didn't see it. Why travel over 100 miles to commit a crime when all the others were in the same general area? The FBI had provided a profile of the murderer, saying he was probably a local Richmond guy, a white male, very intelligent, who lived alone or with a domineering female figure, extremely combative toward women, had trouble dating or holding down a job, could have a criminal record, committed murders on weekends because he had a weekday job and didn't want anyone to see him after he killed, was stalking the women, and stealing items from the scenes as trophies. Richmond police thought they were dealing with a white serial killer and a black rapist. A little dismissively, "We do have two alpha male police detectives from the 80s here, folks." Williams told Horgus that he could come down to Richmond's task force meeting the next morning. Horgus took him up on it. I need you to imagine a little police work montage here, where the task force and Horgus compared crime scene photos only to discover that the knots used were identical, etc., etc. But realizing that one man was murdering women in RVA and Arlington didn't really help when almost no physical evidence had been left behind to lead to a suspect. The investigation stalled for weeks. On Monday, December 28th, Horgus personally delivered samples of genetic material from the Tucker and Hom murders, as well as several of the Arlington rapes, to Life Codes in Valhalla, New York. Results would take at least 6 weeks, possibly 10. When he returned to Virginia, Horgus consulted with FBI profilers from the Behavioral Science Unit in Quantico with his updated theory that the masked rapist, Carolyn Hom's murderer, and the serial killer were the same person. Agents Judson Ray and Steve Mardigian agreed. According to an article by Laurie McClellan for Arlington Magazine, the profiler said that the attacker would have committed his first assault in a place where he felt comfortable, most likely his own neighborhood. The agents also told Horgus that based on psychological profiling, such a perpetrator would only stop attacking women if he died or was locked up, meaning the dates on which the rapes and murders had occurred, and the gaps between, were telling. They advised Horgus to look for someone who had been arrested for burglary shortly after the Hom murder in January 1984 and released just before the first Richmond murder in September 1987. Speaking of the BSU, here's a quick plug. If you haven't watched Mindhunter on Netflix, you're way behind. Binge that immediately. It's so well done. I would watch Jonathan Groff do anything. I mean, most of us have literally watched him spit and been like, okay, now do it in my mouth. But Cameron Britton, the guy who does a terrifyingly brilliant job of playing Ed Kemper, makes the entire first season. Kudos to the casting directors. On Wednesday, December 30th, Horgus and his partner, Detective Mike Hill, started searching through parole records. Again, this was the 80s, so everything was on paper, and each parole record had to be manually cross-checked with criminal records. You can imagine how tedious and time-consuming that was, but the detectives checked 300 files in the first day. During this process, Horgus remembered a guy named Timmy.
Timmy!
A neighborhood burglar he had investigated a decade before. Horgus couldn't remember the dude's last name until it finally popped into his head on Wednesday, January 6, 1988. Timothy Spencer. Horgus did some searching and found Spencer's police record. He was born on Saturday, March 17, 1962, in the Green Valley neighborhood of Arlington, Virginia, making him 22 years old when Carolyn Hom was murdered. His criminal career began at the age of 9 when he was charged with larceny and setting fire to a school. At 11 years old, he was charged with larceny again. At 14 years old, it was burglary. He also tortured and killed neighborhood and family pets in sadistic ways. This kid's a gem. When Spencer was 15, he was committed to a juvenile correction center. Released on supervision the following year, he was arrested again within 8 months for burglary. He was committed to Beaumont Learning Center, but 1 year after his release, he was sentenced to 5 years in the Virginia State Penitentiary as an adult for burglary. On Monday, December 14, 1981, Spencer was released on mandatory parole after serving 6 months. Within a month, he was arrested on 3 new charges. His parole was revoked, and he was returned to custody. He was released on parole again in May 1983, but was arrested yet again in January 1984 on 2 burglary charges. While in custody, Spencer was evaluated by psychologists as a potential disciplinary and security problem. He was characterized as lazy, greedy, self-indulgent, directionless, uncooperative, and unreliable unless adequately supervised. Spencer participated in a vicious beating of 2 newly incarcerated inmates who were threatened with rape if they reported the beatings, and on 2 separate occasions, he set fires in the penitentiary. According to court documents, in 1986 and again in 1987, the parole board denied him because his recidivism indicated that he was an unacceptable parole risk. His mandatory release date was not to be until 1991. That arrest in January 1984 for burglary was in Alexandria, just 4 days after Carolyn Hom's body was found. Spencer was wearing a cream-colored Eisenhower jacket. On Friday, September 4th, 1987, Spencer was given into the custody of a halfway house to finish his sentence. That facility was called Hospitality House and was located at 1500 and 1502 Porter Street in Richmond. It was 2 weeks before Debbie Davis was killed. Let me give you a quick rundown. 14 rapes, 21 attacks, 5 murders. And not quick, painless, terror-free murders. No. Timothy Spencer violently and repeatedly raped and sodomized his victims, then strangled them until they lost consciousness, allowed them to revive, and did it again, over and over for his sexual gratification until he finally killed them. The way he bound his victims was no accident either. If they struggled, it tightened the ligature around their neck. Debbie Davis was a 35-year-old account manager at Style Magazine. She'd moved from Lynchburg to be near her cousin, they were more like sisters, who lived with her family in Westover Hills. Hospitality House was less than 3 miles from Debbie's apartment. Spencer was signed out from 7:30 p.m. on Friday, September 18th, until 12:30 a.m. on Saturday, September 19th, and I feel like I'm misunderstanding the point of a fucking halfway house. Dr. Susan Hellams was a 32-year-old resident in neurosurgery at MCV, the Medical College of Virginia. Her husband was a law student at the George Washington University in D.C. and only came home on the weekends. The halfway house was less than 2 miles from Susan's home. Spencer was signed out from 7:45 p.m. on Friday, October 2nd, and didn't return until 1:45 a.m. on Saturday, October 3rd. Diane Cho was a brilliant 15-year-old student at Manchester High School who wanted to become a doctor. Her family had just moved to Virginia in 1987. The halfway house was approximately 6 miles from the Cho's apartment across from Cloverleaf Mall. Spencer was signed out from 7:15 p.m. on Saturday, November 21st, until 8:25 p.m. on Sunday, November 22nd. That's over 24 hours. If you're feeling ragey right now, it's warranted, and you'll be happy to know that Hospitality House is no longer in operation and that Debbie Davis's dad sued the shit out of him. They weren't even supposed to have custody of Spencer because he didn't meet the contract criterion. He wasn't a mandatory parolee. He wasn't a revoked parolee with less than 6 months remaining to serve. He hadn't been granted parole, and he demonstrated a pattern of violence. 1500 and 1502 Porter Street are private residences these days, with a combined sale price of over $1 million. Talk about gentrification. Sue Tucker was 44 years old. Her husband, Reg, was from Wales. He'd recently accepted a job and moved back there. Sue was finishing up her projects at the Department of Agriculture and getting their townhome ready for sale so she could join him. They'd decided to move because they were concerned about violence and crime in the U.S. Spencer's mother's house was about a mile away from Sue's townhouse in Arlington. Spencer was on furlough from the halfway house, visiting his mother for Thanksgiving. His mom's house was also less than a mile from Carolyn Hom's house and only 200 yards from the Oxford Street location where the first rape was committed. All murder victims were killed by ligature strangulation. Each had had their hands bound. Each had been subjected to forcible rape and sodomy. Each was overcome quickly without the opportunity to struggle or call for help. None showed defensive wounds. Police believe that Spencer was already in their homes, watching and waiting. There were unusually large amounts of semen on or around the bodies of the murder victims. Entry was always gained by a window. All the Richmond victims frequented Cloverleaf Mall. Police believe that Spencer selected and stalked his victims there, watching them for days before striking. Debbie Davis worked part-time at Walden Books in the mall. Dr. Susan Hellams had purchased books there, writing a check that was endorsed by Debbie Davis. Diane Cho and her friends, being teens, were there all the time. Diane told her friends that someone had been following her for about 2 weeks, and they actually saw him watching her while they were buying tickets to see the Princess Bride. The open jar of Vaseline found at the Hellams crime scene was purchased at a drugstore across from the mall. You may remember that Vaseline was also used as a lube during one of the Arlington rapes. Hang in there, y'all. We're almost done. Because there was no hard evidence and only Horgus's theory, Arlington County Prosecutor Helen Fahey was torn. Arrest Spencer with nothing to link him to the crimes and endanger future prosecution, or let a probable killer roam free. Because grand jury indictments are more difficult to challenge in court than arrest warrants, Fahey decided to take that route. On Wednesday, January 20th, 1988, the grand jury returned indictments for rape, murder, and burglary in the killing of Sue Tucker. Horgus called Williams to let him know that they were coming for Spencer. That afternoon, Horgus, the Williams boys, as the Richmond detectives were called, and a team of plainclothes officers arrested Spencer at Hospitality House. When they searched his room, they found two long, sturdy screwdrivers, the kind favored by burglars, a wool stocking cap, a pair of winter gloves, a camouflage jacket, a folding hunting knife, and a box of .25 caliber ammo. Both of those last things are parole violations. They flipped his mattress and found the infinity symbol, or the number 8, which corresponded to his room number, under the words "I hope" written on the fabric of his box springs. They did not find the pink nail polish or any of the other potential trophies. FBI profilers had cautioned Horgus not to mention the murders or rapes. Due to the lack of traditional physical evidence, they needed one of two things from Spencer, a confession or a blood sample. After hours of interrogation, Horgus asked again for a blood sample, telling Spencer that it was needed to compare to some blood found on a broken window in a burglary case. Well, Spencer knew that he hadn't cut himself, so he agreed. With the science of DNA testing in its infancy, it's likely that Spencer never realized that a blood test could be used to match a semen sample. Gotcha, bitch. Once again, Horgus boarded a plane to New York, hand-carrying Spencer's blood sample to Life Codes. Once again, he was told that results would take at least 6 weeks. In a tragic turn of events, on Wednesday, February 3rd, 1988, Detective Glenn Williams intentionally shot himself in his chest and died. He'd had a lot of things going on in his personal life. On Wednesday, March 16th, 1988, the Life Codes results were in, and DNA determined that Timothy Spencer was garbage. Spencer was indeed the masked rapist, Carolyn Holmes' killer, and the Southside Strangler. Life Codes testing showed that the statistical likelihood of finding duplication of Spencer's particular DNA pattern in the population of members of the black race who live in North America is 1 in 705 million. In addition, the evidence also showed that the number of black males living in North America was approximately 10 million. Other forensic scientists determined that glass fragments found in Spencer's camouflage jacket matched the optical properties of Tucker's broken basement window. Only 2% of glass examined at the state laboratory had the same optical properties. Now it was time to convince jurors to believe in the validity of something they'd never even heard of. Fahey was nervous because this was a case where there was essentially DNA and almost nothing else. And when you were talking about capital murder, it was asking a lot of a jury to believe this new technology was sufficient to convict beyond a reasonable doubt. According to Laurie McClellan, the science was so new, in fact, that the judge in the case, Benjamin Kendrick, had to hold a special hearing prior to Spencer's court date to determine whether DNA evidence was legally admissible. It was very controversial at the time, in a lot of circles, says Kendrick. A lot of people said it was hocus pocus. I made the decision that it was reliable and was going to be admitted. Okay, judge. Spencer would go on to face juries in 4 back-to-back capital murder trials, beginning with Sue Tucker's in July of 1988, then Debbie Davis's in September, Dr. Susan Hellam's in January of 1989, and Diane Cho's in May. The semen recovered at the Cho murder scene was contaminated with menstrual blood and bacteria, and the sample size wasn't as large or as pure as what was recovered at some of the other murder scenes. So PCR DNA amplification was used in a murder trial for the first time. PCR stands for polymerase chain reaction. According to trial documents, this process replicates isolated DNA to permit a comparative analysis. The analysis thus made identified Spencer's DQ alpha genotype as 1.2 and 2, which occurs in about 5% of the population. The victim's DQ alpha genotype was 3 and 4. The DQ alpha genotype found in the DNA isolated from the victim's vaginal smear, as well as that found on the 3 bedsheet stains, was identical to Spencer's and unlike the victim's. This particular DQ alpha genotype, combined with Spencer's blood type and enzyme grouping, results in a combination that occurs in slightly less than 1% of the population. This breakthrough testing method went on to win the Nobel Prize for Chemistry in 1993, and the next time it made big news was in the O.J. Simpson trial in 1994. Timothy Spencer was convicted in all 4 trials, making him the first serial killer in the United States to be convicted on the basis of DNA. He was never charged with Carolyn Holmes' rape and murder, as he'd already been given multiple death sentences. He was sent to Greensville Correctional Center in Jarrett, Virginia, where on Wednesday, April 27, 1994, he faced Old Sparky, Virginia's electric chair, and was pronounced dead at 11:13 p.m. According to Lee Laughlin, a veteran police investigator who witnessed Spencer's execution, the warden asked Spencer if he cared to say any final words, a time when many condemned murderers ask for forgiveness and offer an apology to family members of the people they'd murdered. He replied, "Yeah, I think..." He let the word think trail away, keeping his thought to himself. Those were the last words spoken by Timothy Spencer, the Southside Strangler. Whatever he'd been about to say, well, he took it with him to his grave. He also took his organs to his grave because he refused to donate them. But what about David Vasquez? He was still in prison for the rape and murder of Carolyn Hum. After so many years in storage, the DNA samples from the crime scene were too degraded. David's only chance at freedom was a gubernatorial pardon, but Horgus and Fahey were on that too. Fahey requested the help of the FBI, including Special Agent John Douglas. Douglas founded the BSU and has interviewed some of the most notorious serial killers, including Bundy. He's the guy Clarice Starling's boss is based on in The Silence of the Lambs, y'all. As Laurie McClellan reports, when Douglas agreed to help Fahey, It was the first time FBI profilers had ever been asked to help prove a suspect innocent. I got involved because one of the things that evolved at that time was linking cases together, Douglas explains. What you look for is a signature. A signature is a ritual. In the Spencer case, Douglas believed the unusual cord bindings constituted a unique signature in all five murders. Citing this and other factors, FBI agent Steve Mardigian drafted a 35-page report, along with a letter, which Douglas also signed, asking for Vasquez's pardon. Fahey sent it, along with her own pardon petition, to Virginia Governor Gerald Balowes in October 1988. On January 4, 1989, Vasquez was released from prison, the first person in the U.S. to be exonerated, albeit indirectly, by DNA evidence. David Vasquez died in 2013 at the age of 66. His friends say that David had no ill feelings. He was known to say that police had just made a mistake. Obviously, this case was a turning point in law enforcement. In 1989, Virginia became the first state to create a crime lab that could test DNA evidence, and also to set up a DNA database. If this all seemed a bit familiar to you, it may be because Patricia Cromwell's first novel, Postmortem, was based on these cases and released in 1990. Cromwell was a computer analyst at the state medical examiner's office at the time of the crimes. Dr. Marcella Fierro, the retired chief medical examiner of Virginia, was inspiration for Dr. Kay Scarpetta, the main character in Cromwell's novels. Speaking of debut novels, please go to Amazon and drop $3.99, less than the cost of your iced coffee, on my dear friend Aidan Murray's first book. It's a fantasy novel featuring a genderqueer protagonist and a lesbian love story. I'll share the link on my Instagram story. Don't forget about the launch giveaway. You can still get a free fandom founder sticker. Check out my story highlights on Instagram for details. These first few weeks are super important for a new podcast. So if you enjoyed this episode, please follow the show, share it with a friend, leave a 5-star rating or review. Follow me on Instagram and or Twitter at @twtcpodcast. Become a patron. The link is in the show notes and in my Instagram bio. There are two tiers, one for general support and one where you get a ton of stuff. Check them out. If a monthly commitment isn't your thing, you can Venmo me. My username is twtcpodcast. Thank you so, so much for listening. Please also listen to every true crime podcaster ever when they tell you to lock your windows, lock your doors. I know you think stuff like this doesn't happen where you live, but if you've learned anything from your true crime obsession, it should be that stuff like this does indeed happen where you live. Just because it hasn't happened yet doesn't mean it's not going to. As the ladies over at Morbid say, fresh air is for dead people. Check out images related to this episode over on Instagram and come back next week for your true crime fix.